Today is Friday, September 18th, and this is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, experts warn that violence is increasing in the U.S. before the November election.
The alarms are flashing red in the U.S. right now for the risk of political violence, and I think we're seeing it sort of tick up now, and it could intensify prior to the election and after the election.
Also ahead, Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko threatens to close borders with European nations. Plus, a look at next week's UN General Assembly. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Taiwan. Chinese aircraft buzzed the island Friday, forcing Taipei to scramble jets in response. The incident took place as a top U.S. diplomat visited Taipei, angering Beijing, which claims sovereignty over the democratically ruled island. The trip by Undersecretary of State Keith Krach is the second by a high-ranking U.S. official in 2 months. For the latest, I spoke to journalist Joyce Huang in Taipei.
Well, shortly before the U.S. Undersecretary of State Keith Krach arrived in Taiwan on Thursday afternoon, China had threatened to take what it called necessary response to Mr. Karak's three-day visit in Taiwan. So what happened earlier Friday morning to this morning was that China sent a total of 18 fighter jets to fly across or near the airspace along Taiwan's west coast. As a usual way of defending itself, Taiwan's Air Force immediately scrambled jets to shadow, to intercept, and to disperse those rival fighter jets through radio warnings. China's defense ministries also announced that its military will launch drills in the Taiwan Strait, which will simulate the actual combat situation. China gave no details, timing, or length of its planned drills, but already analysts say this sends a strong warning to both the U.S. and Taiwan in terms of the strengthening of their political and economic ties without China's consent.
And why is this visit by the U.S. diplomat so important to China that it would prompt them to send these aircraft?
In principle, China views and rejects any official exchange between Taiwan and the U.S. because it sees that act as a violation of its so-called One China principle. The principle states that there's only one China in the world and that the self-ruled Taiwan is part of China. And China has been urging the U.S. to honor the principle for many years. So this time around, Mr. Karak is the highest ranking U.S. official to visit Taiwan in the past four decades. That carries a huge symbolic meaning that suggests that there are warming relations between President Donald Trump's administration and the independence-leaning DPP government. That, I think, certainly angered the Chinese government, which sees the DPP as the what it called separatists.
Have there been any other responses from Taiwan to this incident?
Well, the government here in Taiwan is very busy with closed doors meeting with Mr. Karak and his delegation. Other than that U.S. delegation, we have another delegation from Japan, which is also visiting. So there is not much strong response to China's military provocation. Officials are calling on China to exercise self-restraint and denouncing such a provocative move that will do harm on the region's peace and stability. And frankly, Taiwan is so used to China's military coercion for decades, so many people here refrain from overreacting.
That was journalist Joyce Huang in Taipei, Taiwan. In Belarus, President Alexander Lukashenko announced he would close the country's borders with Lithuania, Poland, and Ukraine. He also spoke of a possible, quote, war, end quote, with neighboring countries, which he accuses of supporting mass protests against his rule. Lukashenko has been in power for 26 years, but weekly protests have brought hundreds of thousands of people to the streets, demanding he step down, following a controversial election in August. For more, I spoke to journalist Charles Maines in Moscow.
Well, Mr. Lukashenko was at a rally yesterday. This is on Thursday. And he started making these impromptu remarks about essentially that the policies of the authorities in his neighboring countries of Lithuania, Poland, and to a degree Ukraine were pursuing policies that were going to lead to war. And so he said at this point he was introducing a full blockade, a border shutting down the border.
And have there been any responses from the neighboring countries?
On the one hand, they say that this border has not closed officially, so there is still foot traffic. They don't know if maybe it's a trade embargo. You know, maybe it stops trucks going through. They don't know, but they also think that this is sort of par for the course. So, for example, the defense minister of Ukraine, who said in terms of Mr. Lukashenko, told them to drink some water and calm down. We've heard from the prime minister of Lithuania, who said he didn't know how seriously to take this. People, in general, I think, trying to figure out what exactly Mr. Lukashenko means.
That was journalist Charles Maines in Moscow. In Geneva, Belarus, Russia, China, and Venezuela have failed to derail a special debate on the human rights situation in Belarus from taking place at the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA.
The debate began with a report by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, which described the violent crackdowns by Belarusian security forces against thousands of peaceful demonstrators following the country's disputed presidential election. However, it was the intervention of the UN Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in Belarus that provoked a firestorm of protests from Belarus and its supporters. They said only representatives of states could speak at a special debate and that others, including the human rights chief and the special rapporteur, must be excluded. The Russian ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Gennady Gatilov, accused the council of violating the rules of procedure. He spoke through an interpreter.
In this case, we once again repeat our request and the request of other states to cease the dialogue with the special rapporteur, which is not provided for by the format for urgent debates with states.
President of the UN Human Rights Council, Elisabeth Tichy-Fisselberger, rejected the assertion.
We are following exactly the procedure we have always had in the case of urgent debates, and this is the sixth in a line, where we start with the High Commissioner and then a limited numbers of speakers who are not necessarily on behalf of states. We've done that before, and that's what we're doing today.
The special rapporteur, Anais Marin, proceeded to present a searing account of the brutal use of force by security officers against journalists, passersby, women, and even children. She said more than 10,000 people have been abusively arrested and thousands savagely beaten. She said she has received reports of more than 500 cases of torture committed by Belarusian state agents.
During the week of 10th of August, hundreds of detainees were subject to humiliating conditions and degrading treatment. I have been informed of allegations of rape, electrocution, and other forms of physical and psychological torture. What is more, the perpetrators seem confident that they will not be prosecuted because of prevailing lawlessness and impunity.
In a video message from Lithuania, opposition candidate in the Belarusian presidential elections, Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya, called for talks with authorities to look for peaceful solutions to the crisis in their country. She demanded an end to violence against peaceful citizens and the immediate release of all political prisoners. Belarus' ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Yuri Ambrazovich, called accusations of sexual violence, forced disappearances, and political detentions of protesters unfounded. He accused the losers of the election of using the mass media and social networks to present a lopsided picture of reality. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA. New details are emerging about accusations that migrant women detained by U.S. authorities were forcibly sterilized. Earlier this week, a nurse who worked at a migrant detention center in the state of Georgia alleged that a doctor was performing hysterectomies on detained women against their will. Those allegations prompted U.S. lawmakers to call for official investigations. An Associated Press review of medical records for four detained women and interviews with lawyers indicate the gynecologist performed surgeries and other procedures that the women had not sought and didn't fully understand. The AP reports that although some procedures may have been done because of problems noted in the medical records, lawyers and medical experts say the women's lack of consent or knowledge raises severe legal and ethical issues. In Japan, tattooing is now legal. Tattoo art has a long history in the Asian nation, but the practice has been in a legal gray area due to a law requiring tattoo artists to be licensed medical professionals. But on Thursday, the country's Supreme Court ruled against that requirement, the GG Press reports. tattoo artists in the country celebrated the ruling. The Three Tides tattoo shop in Tokyo said on Instagram, quote, "Finally not guilty. We don't need to be a doctor anymore," end quote. While Japanese tattoo art is world famous, some in Japan view tattoos as taboo due to its association with organized crime. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Surges in COVID-19 cases around the world are prompting consideration of new lockdowns. Israel returned to full lockdown Friday afternoon to try to contain an outbreak that has steadily worsened as its government has been plagued by infighting. The closures coincide with the Jewish high holidays when people typically visit their families and gather for large prayer services. The UK is also considering a fresh lockdown after new COVID-19 cases have almost doubled to 6,000 per day. The United Kingdom has reported the fifth largest number of deaths from COVID-19 in the world after the United States, Brazil, India, and Mexico, the Johns Hopkins University in the U.S. says. COVID-19 will be on the top of the agenda at the United Nations General Assembly next week in New York. For more on the annual summit, I spoke to VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir.
It's going to be a very different General Assembly this year. Normally, we have at least 100 presidents and prime ministers and royalty coming to New York attending these meetings. And some people call it diplomatic speed dating because you have all these bilateral meetings among the leaders. And there's a lot of in-person, face-to-face contact. And that's what makes the UN General Assembly week so important. But this year, of course, due to the coronavirus pandemic, it's going to be essentially a virtual meeting of world leaders. And so this has presented challenges, but it's also presented opportunities. One of the opportunities is that it's easier for people to participate, and they have actually a record participation for this year. There's about 120 heads of state attending virtually and 54 heads of government. And normally you'd get maybe 70 or 80 heads of state coming and maybe 30 heads of government. So it's a much bigger, higher level representation. They will give pre-recorded statements that will be played in the General Assembly. And it's that big iconic hall with the dome. This year, it will not be full of people because of COVID-19. Only one representative will be allowed from each country, which basically is their ambassador at the United Nations.
So what will be the main items on the agenda at the General Assembly?
Definitely COVID will be the topic, but we're also going to hear about rebuilding sustainably, coming back from this pandemic in a better place. It's shown in inequalities throughout the world, inequalities in healthcare and in jobs and things like that. So there's going to be a lot of discussion about how the world comes back from this stronger and more sustainable. And that also includes action on climate change, because that has really been a flagship issue for the UN. And it would have probably been the top issue at this General Assembly if it hadn't been for COVID. But it really is a part of the pandemic. So it will become a part of the recovery from it.
That was VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir. With less than 50 days until the U.S. election, concerns are growing over interference in the vote. Late Thursday, FBI Director Christopher Wray said Russia has been, quote, very active, end quote, in its efforts to influence U.S. elections.
Yes, I think the intelligence community's consensus is that Russia continues to try to influence our elections, primarily through what we would call malign foreign influence, as opposed to what we saw in 2016, where there was also an effort to target election infrastructure, you know, cyber targeting. We have not seen that second part yet, but I think in many ways what concerns me the most is the steady drumbeat of misinformation and sort of amplification of smaller cyber intrusions that contribute over time. I worry that they will contribute over time to a lack of confidence of American voters and citizens in the validity of their vote.
Ray told lawmakers that Russia is primarily interfering through malign foreign influence in an effort to hurt Democratic candidate Joe Biden's campaign.
But we certainly have seen very active efforts by the Russians to influence our election in 2020 through what I would call more the malign foreign influence side of things. Social media, use of proxies, state media, online journals, et cetera, an effort to both sow divisiveness and discord, and I think the intelligence community has assessed this publicly, to primarily to denigrate Vice President Biden and what the Russians see as kind of an anti-Russian establishment. That's essentially what we're seeing in 2020.
Russia did not immediately comment on Ray's testimony. Multiple reviews by U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded that Russia acted to boost President Donald Trump's 2016 campaign and undermine his Democratic rival, Hillary Clinton. The Republican president has long bristled at that finding, which Russia denies. Thursday night, Trump played down Ray's testimony about Russia in a tweet and said the bigger threat is meddling with mail-in ballots. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, most U.S. states will increase voting by mail for November's election rather than requiring people to vote at a polling station. That has become a major controversy. President Trump has argued that mail-in voting could be used to rig the election against him. His appointee at the U.S. Postal Service has carried out cutbacks and new policies that have slowed some mail delivery. Democrats accuse Trump of attacking the Postal Service to suppress voting. Late Thursday, a federal judge ordered an end to the cutbacks to the Postal Service. AP's Jackie Quinn has more.
A federal judge in Washington State says the Postal Service cutbacks are politically motivated and has granted an injunction against the changes. 14 states sued the Trump administration and the Postal Service, and Judge Stanley Bastian agreed, calling the changes a politically motivated attack on the efficiency of the Postal Service before the November election. Judge Bastian issued a nationwide preliminary injunction and expressed concerns that changes create a substantial possibility voters will be disenfranchised. The judge said President Trump had repeatedly attacked voting by mail by making unfounded claims about fraud. A government attorney vowed the Postal Service would handle election mail promptly. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Amid the worries of election interference, another concern is rising violence. A spike in political violence over the last month in the U.S. has experts ringing alarm bells of further unrest leading up to the vote. There have been shootings and other attacks on protesters in various U.S. cities in recent weeks. Risa Brooks is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University in Wisconsin and an expert on American civil-military relations. She told me that she thinks the political responses to the violence have made the situation worse.
I think things are really intensifying, and there's just no question about that. In particular, an incident in Kenosha that's actually not very far from where I live here in Wisconsin, in which self-described vigilante 17-year-old kid shot three protesters who had been in the streets after Jacob Blake got shot by police, and there was sort of massive protests. That incident, and then also another one in Portland, in which a sort of pro-Trump protester was killed in the aftermath, I think in the evening hours after a protest, and then that individual was subsequently shot to death in a confrontation with police. In addition, there's been incidents involving sort of people driving their cars into protests and just heightened inflammatory rhetoric all around, and very upsetting. I think sort of to summarize it, to use that sort of standard phrase, the alarms are flashing red in the U.S. right now for the risk of political violence. And I think we're seeing it sort of tick up now, and it could intensify prior to the election and after the election. And I think it's a pretty worrisome time right now in the United States for that reason.
Now, what's behind this spike in violence?
Basically, you know, we have intense polarization in the United States. What I mean by that is there's sort of cleavages along racial, religious, ideological, and geographic lines, and these don't cross-cut each other. They intersect and reinforce each other. So you have sort of whole groups that are completely separate from each other. And then you have this sort of language that some politicians are using or political figures that's very dehumanizing, circulating in social media and being picked up, and is adding to this idea that not only are people that don't agree with you sort of people that you might not want to hang out with, but they're sort of evil and, you know, intent to sort of destroy your life and livelihood. You have a lot of opportunistic language and behavior by some politicians. And, you know, basically these dynamics are in place. And now you have an election, a highly contentious election approaching. And incidents and more mobilization over racial injustice and sort of a greater awareness of some of the deep problems in the country right now. And that sort of cocktail seems to be manifesting in a greater incidence of political violence and potential for even more.
When you talk about different politicians, is this coming from across the political spectrum?
Not really. I think if you look at sort of who's saying this kind of, using this kind of language, it's, you know, particular individuals. The other day, you know, the attorney general of the country's attorney general, top law enforcement officer, so to speak, you know, was saying those who were engaging in violence or criminal acts during protests should be charged with sedition, with insurrection. You know, that's an extreme sort of formulation of that kind of activity, right? You know, people should be held accountable for their crimes, but to sort of label them as somehow sort of rebels is really just a step beyond. And Trump himself saying things like he was asked in the last few days if he had clearly won the Electoral College and folks were protesting what he would do about it. And he talked about calling it insurrection if that were to happen. So that suggests that he's thinking in terms of the Insurrection Act, thinking in terms of using sort of a massive amount of force, unwarranted force against people who don't agree with him or don't agree that maybe he won the election. And that's a pretty inflammatory kind of framing and will likely escalate things if he does follow through on those sorts of threats.
That was Risa Brooks, an associate professor of political science at Marquette University in Wisconsin. That's it for our show today. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Despite historic tensions, Serbia and Kosovo have taken courageous steps to normalize economic relations. On September 4th, the two countries signed agreements brokered by the United States, finalizing commitments to cooperate on a broad range of economic issues. During the signing ceremony at the White House, President Donald Trump said the decision by Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić and Kosovo Prime Minister Abdullah Hoti to work together has made the region and the world safer.
After a violent and tragic history and years of failed negotiations, my administration proposed a new way of bridging the divide. By focusing on job creation and economic growth, the two countries were able to reach a major breakthrough. We're very proud of these two great leaders and for getting this done, and their people are very proud of them. Maybe more importantly, it is historic.
Following the breakup of Yugoslavia in the early 1990s and the subsequent Balkan Wars, Kosovo broke from Serbia and declared its independence in 2008, a status Serbia has refused to recognize. Over the past 20 years, Western efforts to broker a comprehensive political normalization agreement between the two countries remained elusive. President Trump's special envoy to Serbia and Kosovo, Richard Grenell, said President Trump was determined to break the stalemate.
What President Trump did from the very beginning is say, let's show them how to develop economics, how to take industries and grow them. Let's flip it. Let's figure out how to do economics first. And let's see if the concentration on economics and job creation can unstick the political stuff. That remains to be seen.
The U.S. brokered economic normalization agreement between Belgrade and Pristina seeks to increase economic growth and job creation and demonstrate the tangible benefits of cooperation. The historic agreement also opens up border crossings and encourages Serbia and Kosovo to recognize each other's diplomas and licenses. In addition, Serbia and Kosovo are participating in the growing movement toward peace in the Middle East. Kosovo and Israel have agreed to normalize ties and establish diplomatic relations. Serbia has committed to moving its embassy to Jerusalem, key steps in strengthening ties between European and Middle Eastern countries. At the White House, President Trump acknowledged Serbia and Kosovo's deep-seated feelings from the past, but he predicted a brighter future. I think they're going to have a tremendous relationship, and the economic is going to bring them together.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.